Here we come, walk down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet.
Hey, hey, we're the monkeys, and people say we're monkeying around. But we're too busy singing to put anybody down.
We go wherever we want to, do what we like to do. We don't have time to get restless. There's always something new.
And good evening. You are listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer. The Dana Pretzer Show starts in just a minute. You're listening to us on cable channel 46 and Trust Cable in Alabama, satellite AMC3 transponder 7, W3957, or on the internet feed at scaredmonkeys.com/radio, whether it's live or on the podcast. Welcome. Tonight, we're going to focus a good part of the show on the tragedy at Virginia Tech, where that psychopath killer went in and waged his destruction for his 15 minutes of fame. It's a tragedy. It's something that can't happen again. And we're going to try and make some sense of it tonight with Clint Van Zandt. Clint has been doing his fair share of reporting on this incident. He's a former FBI agent and president of Van Zandt Associates. Then we're going to get the perspective, because you can take this story and report on it about 15 different ways. We're going to talk to Larry Pratt. He's the executive director of the Gun Owners of America. And we're going to talk to him about, could this tragedy have been reduced if guns were allowed on campus? And then the police perspective. Pete Bollinger, he's a police officer and author of How to Get Hired in Law Enforcement and Fire, will be here. And then Eric Spinato, he's a senior cable news producer. We're going to talk about a high-profile case that he worked on called the Texas Cadet Murder Case and how he feels the media has been doing reporting this Virginia tragedy. And then a little later on with our missing person segment, we'll talk to Cheyenne Jackson about her missing brother Cole and a very special story that she has about a dying boy who has a special wish to get a birthday card from you. That's tonight here on the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio, and we'll be back in just a minute with Clint Van Zandt. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show for April 20th, 2007. The Virginia Tech shootings is a tragedy. It's something that should never happen, but did happen. And like I said in my introduction, we're going to focus a good part of my program talking about this tragedy tonight from several different perspectives. I thought I would invite Clint Van Zandt on the program to talk about his reporting on the incident. He's been very busy with it. And maybe go into the head a little bit of the shooter and what caused this thing to happen. Clint, how are you?
Hey, good evening, Dan. Just fine, thanks.
I know you've been busy. You've been nonstop on TV talking about this. And then we had another incident at a hostage taking at NASA, I believe. And
correct.
It just seems to never end. The Virginia Tech shooting is something that, well, it's a tragedy for sure. And I'm going to focus on it tonight with several different perspectives, right down from the executive director of the Gun Owners of America to police officers to a cable news producer. I want you to talk a little bit about the shooter. He talks about being a martyr, like his heroes from Columbine, Harrison, Klebold. Mm-hmm. What was going on with this guy?
Well, you know, Dana, the only thing really different from this situation than any other sad, emotionally challenged, quasi-crazy, pathetic, cowardly individual who does something like that. Something like this is the loss of life. The loss of life was so horrendous. I mean, had this guy leaned out a window and took a shot at me and grazed my arm and I bled a little bit and he put the gun to his head, I mean, that would have been an absolute half a blip on a radar screen. But, of course, by the carnage that he was able to let, it changed this whole thing. But, you know, when you start to do a psychological autopsy on some guy like this, it's every time I've ever looked at one of these shootings, every time I've ever helped a client in a violence in a workplace situation, the signs, the flags, the indicators are always there. And the issue is not that they weren't there, but that people, number one, identify them. Number two, right. Were they able to put all the pieces together, all the flags together? Did they respond to it appropriately? Did they just disregard it? Did they throw their hands in the air out of frustration and not deal with it? This is someone who had who provided every indicator that he was challenged. As you well know, back in November or December of 05, he had attempted to clumsily communicate with two different co-eds who really didn't appreciate it. They thought they were being stalked and notified the university police department. Cho was subsequently interviewed. It didn't take long before he had a 48-hour psych eval, and during that psych evaluation, as you know, in Virginia, you have to show someone is a clear and immediate threat to themselves or others to have a non-voluntary commitment. And the psychologist couldn't find that. He said, you know, this guy's challenged, he's depressed, he's got a lot of other things going on, but he said, I don't see that he presents a threat to himself. Well, as you know, Cho was a Korean, a 23-year-old Korean, an English major, who was born in Korea, came to the United States about 1992, but it was still someone, you know, who was challenged with the English language, who was challenged by our culture. Now the stories are coming out that you would expect, saying when he was in high school, he was made fun of because of his accent, right, because he was clumsy socially. Then when he got to college, this continued, that no one really had anything to do with him. But, you know, part of this, most of this is him, too. I mean, there was an international community of thousands of students amongst the 26,000 students at Virginia Tech. I mean, there were internationals that he could have made friends with, that if he really felt estranged from the native-born U.S., then he could have found others. But he didn't do that. This is someone, Dana, who built this psychological bubble around himself, and he refused to let others in. The closest anyone ever got to this guy was one party, some of his roommates, who never even spoke to him, and vice versa. They got him to go to a party one night, and after a couple of beers, he started talking about this imaginary girlfriend he had who was a supermodel. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy's mind was a fantasy, and it was caught up with imaginary girlfriends. But more than that, it was caught up with rage, anger, frustration, and martyrdom, where he was a martyr. He was victimized by everybody around him. And somewhere along the line, Dana, this guy made a decision that he was going to be the great avenger. He was the one that was going to go out and level the playing field and get revenge against anyone who had ever done anything to him across the board. You know, this is the type of guy, if it's you and I, Dana, we look in a mirror and we say, well, you know, part of the problem is the guy I'm looking at right there in the mirror.
Right.
Cho is the type of guy who turns around and looks out the window and he says, all of the problems, all my frustrations are represented out there. And when he did his killings, when he went on this killing spree this last Monday, especially after the first two, the female student and the dormitory resident assistant were killed, and then 2 hours later he moves on to a classroom building where he slaughters 30 students, methodically moving through four different classrooms, 9mm, 22, round after round, double-tapping, triple-tapping the victims as they're laying on the floor, and moving from person to person again. This is someone who felt justified, who felt he had a right to do it, who had been able to dehumanize his peers, these students, because he didn't really see them as peers. He didn't even see them as human beings. and he just moved from room to room, methodically slaughtering these people while they begged for life, while they cried, while they bled, while they prayed, while they vomited, and while they died.
You talked about the psychological autopsy, and I'm not going to keep you very long because I know you've been very busy and you probably need to have your own quiet time so you can get back on a straight and narrow path here. But this whole releasing of the tapes of him and his rants and our discussion and our reporting, I'm going to talk to Eric Spinato here in a little bit about the media perspective in all of this. We want to educate the people. We want to educate the students and the families about these types of cases to try and maybe prevent something like this, or maybe to deal with something like this if it happens, and sadly it will probably happen again somewhere.
Yeah.
Are we right to report it the way that we have been reporting it, Clint?
No. No, absolutely not. I mean, I had no idea what was going to come out. I hadn't seen any of this material, and I was on the NBC Evening News with Brian Williams on Wednesday night when Brian broke this. And I was just aghast that it had been released. And the following morning, I was on the Today Show, and Matt Lauer asked me, he said, Clint, should we NBC, which, you know, who writes my paycheck, he said, should NBC have released these? And I said, absolutely not.
Right.
I said, we never should have released this. We never should have gone public. In fact, I'm starting to write a column again for MSNBC.com called Profiles Perspective. And I just sent my article in about an hour ago. And the article concerns this very topic. And my premise, and I'm sure, you know, from your background, you might echo some of all of what I'm saying, is that, number one, it frustrates me that this cowardly killer can go to his grave and 2 days later reach out from the grave, grab us by the throat, and rub our faces in his picture, in his words, in his rambling, crappy diatribe, and not give us the chance to say, no, this is wrong. No, that didn't happen. No, your thinking is off base. No, you are 100% wrong. He didn't give us the chance to say he was wrong. Number two, the template that we give those people who are sitting on the edge of the abyss out there and making a decision whether they're going to jump in and do something terrible, I hate to give someone a template of how you get your 15 minutes or 5 days of fame, and that's what we provided by doing this. Number three, we put the attention on this sick, tragic, cowardly killer instead of on the victims where it belongs. And number four, we are feeding this eating frenzy that we have as public where we feel we need to know this. No, there's a big difference between the media's commitment to the public and the public's absolute right to know. And as far as I'm concerned, they could have showed one picture of this guy, his face that he took of himself. They could have said, and he provided this rambling diatribe full of profanity in which he blamed everybody else for what he did. Bam, that's it. That's all that should have come out. And, you know, I think there's a 50-50 chance I'll probably get fired within a week for saying and doing this, but so be it. I mean, it, you know, if you can't call it the way you see it, and I tell you what, if I was king, you know, for a day, I would have kept that in the original form. I would have got it from NBC and said, don't make a copy, just give it to the, you know, to the investigators, in my case, the FBI. We would have shown it to the authorities down there. We would have had the FBI behavioralist and others work with the original copy while somebody stayed there and monitored it. No copies would have been made. We would have told the family members, if you need to see it or hear it on this particular day in this particular room, please come. We'll show you. We'll talk to you about it. No copies will be made. You have to promise not to go public with it, and then we're going to seal this damn thing up, and it is never going to see the light of day. That's kind of how I feel.
Well, exactly, and I agree with you 100%. You're giving a psychopath, a killer, a massacrist, his 15 minutes of fame. BTK wanted it. Unabomber wanted it, and the media keeps repeating this stuff, and it just traumatizes people over and over again. Clint, I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Dana.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
That's Clint Van Zandt. Let's look at this now from the perspective of, could this tragedy have been minimized if Virginia Tech wasn't a gun-free zone? Some people will think that this is a bit wacky, but if a teacher, if a professor, if a janitor, if someone had been trained and was carrying a weapon and could have challenged Cho, yeah, you probably would have had loss of life, but maybe it wouldn't have been so bad. Let's listen to this interview. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. In our continuing coverage of the massacre at Virginia Tech, I've decided to bring on Larry Pratt. Larry Pratt's the executive director of the Gun Owners of America. He's been doing that for over 30 years. The Gun Owners of America has a national membership of 300,000 Americans dedicated to promoting their Second Amendment freedom to keep and bear arms. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good to be with you.
This is a tragedy. I don't think anyone can say anything but that. But there's more to the story. I go back to 9/11 and the call to arm pilots in the cockpits of their airplanes, that if someone had had a gun on the airplanes on 9/11, it may have been a different story. I agree with that. I want to talk to you a little bit about gun-free school zones, Virginia. And if someone had been armed in this situation, would there have been a different story?
Well, we can actually answer the question in terms of some cases that were virtually like that. There have been, over the last decade or so, 10 of these types of shootings that did get stopped quite prematurely from the murderer's point of view. And in every case, it involved someone, a potential victim, really, at the scene who had a gun, not a police officer, because the police officers, not surprisingly, are not around by the choice of the murderer. They wait until, quote-unquote, the coast is clear.
Right.
But in the case, for instance, the most recent one, 2 hours down the road in Virginia, Grundy, Virginia, is the site of the Appalachian School of Law, and a shooting very similar in its characteristics to the one that occurred in Virginia Tech began in a January morning. A disgruntled student killed a couple of teachers and one other person. At the first sounds of the shots, a couple of the students ran off the rather smaller campus, which that would have been a factor too, because they couldn't keep guns on them because that was against the law. But they went to their vehicles, got guns, came back, and as the shooter was reloading, I would say getting ready to kill some more, when he saw their guns, he surrendered. And that was the end of the killing spree. And instead of 32 dead, three had died. A lot of lives were obviously potentially saved by what those armed students were able to do, even though they technically had illegal guns when they did it. And I think that's one of the significant things in this whole debate that should show us where we need to be going. Why would we have a law making those guns illegal when nobody's going to convict them?
Right.
They were not prosecuted. Of course, if a law can't find a jury outside of maybe Brooklyn or San Francisco to convict, that's probably not a good law, and we should be getting rid of it. Something which we attempted a couple of years ago in Virginia and failed. And when we failed, and these are words that I'm going to point to that I hope ring in the man's ears for decades.
Right.
Spokesman for Virginia Tech said, well, the Virginia Tech community is very pleased with the outcome that allows us to continue our gun ban on Virginia Tech campus. This will make the Virginia Tech community feel much safer. Well, they probably felt safe, at least many of them, but obviously they weren't safe. And one of the ways of underscoring how I think ideas, attitudes may hopefully be changing, a letter to the editor by a Virginia Tech student was sent to the Roanoke paper, which is just up the road from Virginia Tech.
Right.
Actually, this gentleman's hometown, I think. And he said, look, I think he said he was 21, but to have a concealed carry permit, he must be at least 21. I have a concealed carry permit, but I didn't take my gun on campus because it would have been illegal. I left it at home. I didn't want to jeopardize my graduate career. But after the shooting on Monday, I must say, I'm beginning to think, if I had been shot on Monday and killed on Monday, that would have jeopardized my graduate career. So it seems to me that people are beginning to come to grips with the fact that being defenseless is a very bad defense.
Well, the ideology of some that say that let's try to take the guns out of the hands of criminals, that the honest citizen does have the right to bear arms. But in a situation like this, with this individual, this psychopathic killer, no matter what the gun laws said or did, he was going to get a gun anyway. This is more of a question of protection, whether or not someone would have been able to challenge him. And you're right, any loss of life, whether it's one, two, or three, is tragic. But if you can save 25 by taking him on, you lose three.
Won't get any argument from the 25.
Right, you won't get any arguments from the 25. The legislature, Virginia, some pundits on the news channels will say that Virginia is a very weak state as far as gun laws go. Your comments on that, sir?
I think we need to ask a question of those advocating additional gun control legislation. Where can you show us a gun control program, law, set of regulations, call them what you want, that have reduced crime, that have kept criminals from getting guns?
Exactly.
When criminals, of course, want guns and do what criminals do, which is to break the law. And of course, they can't show you that. They can point to Washington, D.C. with a gun ban, and all they can show you is the highest murder rate in the country, of any jurisdiction in our country. If they take you to England, they show you a country rapidly coming apart at the seams, country, an island with a gun ban. And for their trouble, the UN, which did a study of the 18 most industrialized countries of the world, found that England has the most violent crime of all of those countries following their gun ban. And in fact, their police estimate that there are at least as many as twice the number of illegal guns in the country now as the number of guns that they confiscated from the legal gun owners back in 1997. So for those to accuse Virginia law of being weak, they really have to have a convincing argument that they have a gun control proposal that is going to work, that is going to keep criminals from getting guns. And if they can't assure us, the law-abiding, that they've got something that really will keep, quote, guns out of the wrong hands, end quote, then it is unconscionable to make it difficult for the rest of the society, the non-criminal element of the society, the huge, overwhelming majority of the society, to be defenseless. Because then all the gun control proponents are doing is making it easier to be a criminal.
Yeah,
the safer working environment. What a brilliant scheme.
Exactly. You're right. If you're just joining us, Larry Pratt's here. We're talking about the Virginia Tech massacre. Apparently, this murdering psychopath had been flagged as a mental health issue. And the question comes up now that when they did the check on him before he bought the Glock, for example, that flag should have come up and he should have never had that Glock in the first place. Is there some tweaking that you do see there as far as the background checks of those that buy guns?
Yeah, I would say that we need to get away from this notion of being concerned whether somebody has some kind of mental health history, because that tells us nothing
right
about whether somebody is a criminal. Criminals have predatory minds, and most criminals, perhaps 99%, whatever the population of the country generally, the same with criminals, are just perfectly normal in their mental health. What's different about criminals is that they are predators. They don't care about the laws. They mock those of us who keep the laws. They understand that makes it easier for them to take advantage of all the rest of us. And so focusing on whether or not this chap had a mental history overlooks the fact he had committed criminal acts.
Exactly.
He had twice been accused of stalking women. That's a criminal offense, which should put you in jail. That wasn't done. He was turned instead over to the mental health system, which can't even agree on what kind, if any, mental illness he did have. Oh, now they all know for sure after the fact. But at the time, there was no agreement. But the one thing that everybody could agree upon is that he had stalked two women, yeah, and that nothing was done about it. There's the problem, not the fact that we don't have enough data in the database to decide who or who should not own a gun. Our problem is we're not dealing with criminals the way we ought to be dealing with them. And then we turn around and say to the rest of the population, but even though we're not serious about dealing with criminals, we don't want you to have a gun either.
Yeah.
Oh, please.
Well, consequences is a big thing. If someone knows that there's consequences for their actions, and vis-a-vis, if you go into a school with a gun and you're wanting to shoot someone, but you know that the teachers may be armed, that somebody may be armed, that may make you think twice. Let's go into the training.
But let me just underscore what you just said. That is really the only kind of consequences, Dana, that these people fear. They don't
right.
fear being apprehended, much less even eventually convicted, which is a smaller chance than even being apprehended,
exactly,
let alone sent off to jail, and even less executed. The only thing they really fear is, as you were describing it, that at the scene of their crime, even if they're suicidal, these monsters want to go out in a quote-unquote big way.
Yeah.
They want their 15 minutes of fame. And if a teacher or a janitor at a secondary school shoots one of these dirtbags down like the dogs that they are, that's not in their plan. That's the only thing. Otherwise, why didn't Mr. Cho go into the city of Blacksburg and try to find 32 victims? Well, because he just might have found somebody with a bullet coming his way after the first or second victim.
Exactly. Exactly. They're cowards. He knew that he'd be going in taking on defenseless people, and that's the way it goes. Let's talk about his 15 minutes of fame, so to speak, these rambling tapes that the media has decided to air. When these crazies like Cho go in and do this sort of thing, their ultimate goal, he talked about Klebold and Harris, the two Columbine shooters, and how they were martyrs, is for him to be looked at as a martyr by other crazies that are out there. Did the media do the
and
wrong?
And we've already seen copycats bringing up. It's been in the news many times now.
Exactly.
Since, that terrible Monday. And we've had fathers calling in calls, well, if you won't do what I want you to do, you're going to see something like Virginia Tech happen in your school.
Yeah.
And we've had students making similar threats all over the country. So there's a copycat nature, which itself, from Mr. Cho's case, evidently a lot of his specific ideas came either from the Columbine dirtbags, or from a bunch of dirtbags that made a violence film in Korea.
Right.
And a lot of what he was doing, apparently, from the very information Mr. Cho sent out, was modeled on this violent South Korean film.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and for us to then take Mr. Cho's stuff and say, okay, all the rest of you dirtbags out there, see if you can equal or beat this record.
Yeah, yeah, and something
that's a real brilliant plan.
Something's wrong for sure. Let's talk about training a little bit. And I hate to focus on the gun opponents, but they're the ones that seem to get most of the press.
Well, most of the mainline media is going to be their echo chamber, so I think you're doing the right thing. We need to answer these arguments, so please shoot, as we say.
I'll shoot from the hip for sure. they say that you don't want to arm people who have no training. Putting guns in the hands of people that have no training, the teacher that goes to take on the shooter in the school may take out three of his own students by mistake. Let's address that.
The people that have concealed carry permits in our country, as I said before, have the lowest murder rate, crime rate of any population in our country. Lower than police officers, lower than ministers and priests, the lowest. And to clamor and to smear these people as saying, oh, we can't dare to have them on campus. You know, the drunken frat parties. Well, we're talking 21 years old, can have that permit anywhere else in the state. But somehow we're saying the campus environment is so toxic that this 21-year-old, this 25, 30-year-old student, or 50-year-old teacher all of a sudden is going to go bananas? Well, if that's really true,
right,
then maybe we better start shutting down universities. I think more correctly, we ought to look and see that Pennsylvania and Utah have no problem with concealed carry on their campuses, and they don't have these problems. As with all these alarmist smears against gun owners, this one in particular is about as vile and baseless as it could be. It just is not that way. It does not happen, and it would have had the possibility of saving many of those 32 lives on Monday, and to say that somehow a 21-year-old with a gun on him is going to be more dangerous on a college campus than he is over in town where there are plenty of bars that he can go to right there.
Mm-hmm.
I almost, at some point, I just can't even continue describing how nasty an argument that is, because it's so untrue.
Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, Larry Pratt is with me, and we're talking about the Virginia Tech massacre. Law enforcement, they're going to come under criticism no matter how they have handled this situation. They weren't quick enough. They didn't do this right. They didn't do that right.
I think we need to jump in on that one. Look, the nature of police work is not to be a bodyguard.
Right.
There's no way they can. The only way they could possibly be would be each one of us have our own armed guard. There's a word for that or a term for that. It's called police state. How do you control the guards when some of them go bad? That's not what we want. We want individuals to be able to be responsible for themselves and to take care of themselves. The police were on that campus when the massacre began. They were there in massive numbers because there had already been
mm-hmm.
first two murders 3 hours prior. They were there investigating that, riot gear, rifles, handguns. They were there, and they were ready for war.
Right.
When the massacre began, they were notified, and they immediately went over to the scene of that crime. By the time they got there, all they needed really was no guns. They only needed 32 body bags.
Yeah, and that's the part that makes you...
And it's not a knock on the police.
No, it's not.
What the knock is on is that we have a legislature and we have a board of trustees of universities that think it's really groovy to leave people defenseless. And so when the murderer struck, he knew it didn't matter that the police were all over the campus, and he knew that. He'd only been over to the post office back on the campus. He knew what was coming down. He knew that he was the reason that the police were there. It didn't bother him a bit because he only needed a few minutes.
We need a federal response to something like this as far as protecting our students, whether they're in high school, a grade school, or the university aspect. If we can't protect our children or our future, I don't know who we can protect. They deserve everything that we can do. What do you call on the federal government to do as far as protecting our students?
The federal government has a gun ban on secondary and primary schools and has given states the authority to opt out of that. And only Utah and Pennsylvania that I know of have done that. The rest of the states are quite happy to let the universities make those decisions or themselves pass laws prohibiting carrying of concealed firearms on those campuses. So we can do two things. We can work to get rid of this insane protection of criminals at the federal level, where part of the problem has come from, and at the same time go into the states as we tried in Virginia and try it again and say, okay, guys, how much blood has to be on your hands before you get the idea that people can only resist when they have the means to resist and that they're going to be attacked only when the cops are not around, and that when you've had people able to get guns, like the teachers that have gotten guns and the students that have gotten guns and gotten back to the scene of the crime in time, they're able to stop killers and have stopped killers. So why don't we model from success, and we need laws that reflect that and enable that, empower people to be able to protect themselves. Part of the problem that we're going to face is that rather than going toward legislation like that, we're facing a big cry that we increase the number of people that can't buy guns and load in all sorts of data at the state level so that mentally mental health problems are put into the database, when that's not going to keep guns out of the hands of criminals. So we're going to talk about more gun control without solving the need for people to be able to protect themselves. And one of the big challenges that we face right now is that the NRA supports that kind of gun control. They support the Brady bill that would expand the number of people that couldn't buy guns based on mental history. And again, I hope I've made the point. From what we know, it's not that somebody may have a mental illness that is a problem for society as far as our safety is concerned. The problem is whether they're a predator or not, whether they're a criminal. And while there may be a handful of criminals that are mentally ill, no more than the handful in the general population that are mentally ill. Mental illness doesn't determine violent criminal behavior. The criminal mind does that. And for us to think that we can treat criminals as medical problems is a big mistake, and unhappily our friends at the NRA are making that mistake. They're hoping that maybe this will keep the people that are looking for even more gun control at bay. Well, actually, it'll do the opposite. Every time you try to appease, all you get is more of the behavior you're trying to appease. And so we are in a critical state, our point. And I'm just hoping that people will want to cry out against this and say, no, don't increase gun control, increase freedom for self-defense. And to do that, we're the only group gun group that's opposing this kind of legislation. I hope people will go to gunowners.org. That's the Gun Owners of America website, gunowners.org. Sign up for a free, you know, I'd love for you to be a paying member of Gun Owners, and maybe eventually people would decide to do that. But the important thing right now is to get on that email alert list that we let people subscribe to for free. Once a week or so, not every day even, but once a week, a single email will come out. This is what's happening in Congress. This is what we would suggest that you do. Here's a sample email. If you like, please send that to your congressman right away, because they need to hear from you. That's how we're going to beat this, if we're going to beat this. And believe me, with the NRA giving cover to people like Carolyn McCarthy, when she had her bill in last year, all of the sponsors of the bill were over 20, were F-rated, anti-gun to the core congressman. This is not a pro-gun measure. This is not going to fight crime. This is not going to keep guns out of the wrong hands, but it's sure going to help keep guns out of other people's hands that should be able to have guns to defend themselves.
Absolutely. You've said it well. Larry, thank you.
Dana, thank you.
Take care, and we'll talk again soon. We'll be right back. And we are back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we've got the perspective of Clint Van Zandt. Okay, he talked about Cho. He talked about the incident itself. Clint Van Zandt is a trained profiler, a hostage negotiator, FBI agent. We've now gone to the gun aspect of it. Could this have been minimized by people being armed? Is gun control working? Does Virginia have soft gun rules? We hear about the families and the victims, and we all pray for them, and my heart goes out to all those that were affected by this, whether you lost a loved one, you were injured, teachers, the trauma is unbearable, something that no one will ever understand unless you've actually been there. One thing that we don't hear much about, except sometimes criticism, is the police response. Pete Bollinger is a police officer who's written a new book, and I thought I'd bring him on the air to talk about the police response to a situation like Virginia Tech. Okay, we're back in our continuing investigation of the massacre at Virginia Tech. I'm bringing on Officer Pete Bollinger, who has a new book, How to Get Hired in Police and Fire, and I ask you to go to his website, www.hiredbypolice.com. And Officer Bollinger and I agree on a huge part of this. It's protecting our children. It's if we can't protect our children in schools, and if we can't protect our children for what they are for us for the future, then something is seriously wrong. Every time we turn on the TV, every time we listen to the radio or look at the internet, we hear of another tragedy that could have been stopped if someone might have been there to stop it and had the means to do that. Officer Bollinger, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much, Dana. And I agree with you. Something is seriously wrong in our country. And, you know, this was just a result. I mean, it's happening more and more frequently. I heard the other day that there were 30 school shootings in the last 12 years. And that was staggering to me because I didn't realize it was that often.
Do you remember as a kid? I know I do. I never remember hearing anything like this, because when we were growing up, there were consequences for what you did. If you brought in a gun to a school, you knew that there'd be a police officer there with a gun pointing it at you to drop your gun, and there'd be consequences. When Cho goes into Virginia Tech, he knows that he is like, he's at a duck shoot, that the ducks aren't going to shoot back, that he is there to live his sick psychopathic fantasy, and all these innocent people are there for him to take out. One teacher, one gun, we might have lost some people, but I don't think it would have been as bad as what it was.
Oh, I agree with you. The people making these gun-free zones, God bless them, they probably have the right intentions. Well, no doubt they do, but they're not living in the real world. We're in a violent society right now, and there's so many mentally ill people. There's so many people with rage problems, so many issues today, that you can't have that anymore. You have to have people that are armed. You have to have you have to have somebody that's able to stop it. Recently, in the last few months, we had the Utah Mall shooting.
Right.
And thank goodness an off-duty officer was there, because the numbers would have probably been just as high as this tragedy at Virginia. And I'm a proponent of a national recruitment for with requirements or with certain guidelines that we have people carrying concealed weapons, providing their certain age limit, meet the psychological profile and evaluation. I think we need to go that direction now.
Some of the gun opponents will say, well, you start arming people who don't know what they're doing, you could have had more students shot by the teacher trying to protect them rather than the psycho that came in to slaughter them. I don't agree with that. Let's talk about the training aspect a bit.
Yeah, I've heard that too. I think that's a silly argument. The duck shoot that you talked about, that's what it was. And if one or two people in the room, be it professors or administrators or whoever, were there, it would have been, at least they would have had an opportunity to survive.
Yeah.
And the training is very important. I'm a proponent of this, maybe the age limit of 27 or something like that, whatever society deemed was appropriate, with maybe a few days of training a year. And you got to remember that this is a last resort type of situation. This is when they corner you in a restaurant, in a Luby's Cafe that happened a few years back, or the mall, or a store, or an elementary school. We have to have the ability to fight back, because if somebody has a handgun and you don't, there's nothing you can do, really.
If Cho had known that the professors are armed, that there were armed security patrolling the hallways, would he have gone in? These types of psychopaths are cowards. They're going to try and get their 15 minutes of fame by going in and doing what they have to do, and then ultimately taking their own lives because they think that they're martyrs, they're living their sick psychopathic fantasy. If he knew that there had been armed people in the school, or for the next show that comes up, and I think that's where the media is failing terribly in this case. We're not trying to discourage the next one from coming up. We're just reporting what happened this time. We have to take the bull by the horns and say, no, no more. And if you try something like this, this is what's going to happen to you. I'm curious your comments, both as a law enforcement officer and as a citizen, as to what the media can do better, or what they have been doing to try and discourage the next one. And sadly, there will be a next one.
Well, you're right, Danny. It is sad that there will be, and there will be. Cho was a coward, and I try not to even... I committed to myself I would not even learn his entire name.
Right, me too.
Yeah, so anyway, with the going to the media, I think, and also going to the law enforcement side, I do think that armed police officers, armed security, armed civilian personnel would have made a difference, either to come up behind him while he's doing this and hopefully not warn him at that point, just take him out. But You and I both, you know, we've been in many pursuits or what have you of murders and assault with a deadly weapon suspects, and they tend to give up when commanded to by an authority. And it's kind of amazing because maybe the reason are they don't want to die, but in this case, he might have just submitted and or maybe even decided not to do it when he saw a uniform or if he knew there were other people with handguns and he couldn't make the type of impact that he wanted. And the media, I think there's two problems in this country, two major problems that are kind of exacerbating our way of life, and that's the media and attorneys.
Right.
And, I think that police officers in general are afraid to do their jobs anymore. Many of them just drive by a situation that they see formulating and decide, you know, if it comes out as a radio call, they'll go back and respond to it and take care of it that way. But they're not initiating activity as much because they're just tired of being on the defensive and tired of getting sued. And then the media, I know we had some situations out here in California that really were very minor. One, I don't know if you guys caught it back there, it was a couple years ago, where an officer slammed a guy on the hood of a car.
Yep, I remember.
Yeah, he lost his job. He went to another officer, lost his job over it. Anyway, they didn't show you the entire fight. I haven't seen it either. It's very hard to get a hold of, but I know people that have seen it. They said it was a vicious fight. This guy was fighting the officer for about 2 full minutes, which you know and I know. It doesn't sound like a lot, but that's an amazing fight.
Yeah, you damn right. And it's
and he was fighting this guy, and then the guy grabs his testicles, what we think happened from the video. But that's all they show. And this poor officer lost his job over. He ended up winning $2 million in a follow-up lawsuit. That wasn't very advertised either, but he ended up winning $2 million, but he can't ever be in law enforcement again. And I thought, boy, that was a shame, because I heard that guy was a good officer. He was doing the right thing. He saw a crime in progress. He took care of it, and he was beaten up for it.
Let's talk about the proactive versus reactive response of police. No matter what the officers would have done here at Virginia Tech, there's going to be some criticism of them. It's coming out now. I do commend the president of the university saying that the officers did the best that they could. But mainstream media always seems to be on the attack against police officers. And you're right, a lot of officers won't respond now until it has to be a reactive rather than a proactive stance. Let's talk about the police officer on the scene. We talk about the victims, that's tragic. We talk about the other students, that's tragic. The psycho that committed the crime, he gets put on the pedestal sometimes, and the other psychopaths that are out there, I know he talked about in his ramblings in the media, the martyrs Klebold and Harris at Columbine, while the other Klebolds and Harrises that are out there seeing him on TV rambling like this are now going to consider this guy a hero. But what about the cops? We don't hear much about them, the guys that do put their lives on the line every day in these types of situations.
Yeah, that's a great question, and the way I look at it is we have a calling, you and I and your father and other law enforcement. It's just something you have to do. It's what I talk about in my book. It's you really don't have a choice in what you selected to do in your life. It's something that's just inside of you. And for that, once you get into it, there's certain things you accept you know, we know there's a possibility that we may not go home at the end of the shift, but one thing that we vow to do, what we have sworn to do, is protect people. And so with my shift, I go over, I have about 20 guys under me, and we go over all the time. We go over, hey, if this happens, because an active shooter will happen, and in fact, I've been involved in them before, not at a school, but in other situations, this will happen. How are we going to react? Well, in the past, it used to be we set up a perimeter and waited for SWAT, and then Columbine happened.
Yep.
And then we've changed our tactics, our way of thinking. Now we get 3 or 4 guys on scene, and we pretty much sprint to where the shots are coming from. And when you think of that, from where the shots are coming from, that's kind of crazy, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we do, and that's what we have to do. I mean, I could not live with myself. If, especially if children, and I consider these college kids, children. I mean, they're American kids. I could not live with myself if I didn't do, or my guys didn't do, everything we possibly could to help them survive.
It's a
It's a
command and control situation. The old days, like you say, you set up a perimeter, you brought in the hostage negotiator, which I'm trained to do, and you tried to establish a dialogue. But when you hear the shots fired, and like we did in the video in this case, and you hear people screaming, it's your job. You're trained to go in and help. And whether you go in with two guys or three guys or you go in by yourself, that's a different situation, Pete. But, you know, the media doesn't focus on that. In fact, the very first thing that we heard from a lot of mainstream media was that the police blew it in this case. I know I cut you off a little bit, but where our time is limited.
Right.
I want to get your perspective as far as the media and law enforcement. We see a lot of talking heads on these cable news shows. They're all lawyers.
Right.
We see a lot of talking hosts. They're all lawyers. We don't see many of the people that have been there, done that, the law enforcement, whoever. I've always thought if we're going to protect people in airplanes and airports with air marshals, why don't we put people in universities to put them in undercover, in plain clothes, armed, so we can protect the students there? What more can we do?
You know, you bring up a lot of great points there, Dana, and I'd love to, I know we don't have the time, but I'd love to talk about each individual one. What more can we do? Well, in this case, there's a lot of situations with immigration here.
Yeah.
This is an isolated case, but this person had a mental illness, and he's a resident alien, and he was able to get a gun, both being in a psychiatric hospital and, being not a citizen, which both kind of amazed me. But I'm not going to dwell on that because he could have gotten guns any other manner of ways. But what we can do is, as a society, I think we need to, like I said before, start arming the civilian populace, not really a militia, but a group scattered across the United States, a large group of responsible Americans that have the training, have the psychological makeup to deal with it, and that carry concealed weapons. And when we're at a mall, when we're at a school, maybe we'll be lucky enough to have one of those people will be present and be able to take action. What we're going to face, more than the school shootings, I think, which are going to continue, no doubt, unfortunately, but I think in the next few years we're going to go ahead and face a lot of terrorism. And the mall shooting, that was a Muslim young man who decided, for whatever reason, to go crazy. I think we're going to see a lot more of that. And if we don't start having people randomly in place, we're going to see a lot of bloodshed in America.
Let's talk about the courts, and it may be a little difficult for you, and I can understand if you don't want to comment on any of your local jurisdiction issues, but the courts themselves have been very weak. I take it back to when I started in policing 24 years ago, and compare it to today, we're more of a rehabilitative society rather than a society that punishes. You do the crime, you do the time. And back then, if someone pulled a gun, they knew that there were mandatory minimum sentences for using a gun in a crime. Today, we see a lot of these, and we'll talk about the immigration situation, a lot of these illegal aliens that come to the United States or to Canada or wherever, commit a crime, they don't get punished, and they're back out on the street again. Let's talk about the court perspective of this, and are the courts doing the jobs that they should be doing?
Well, I was just in the prosecution unit for about 2 years prior to coming back out to the street, and have a lot of DA friends, and no, I'm not afraid to comment on anything. I'm done with the politically correct days. I'm where I want to be in my rank. And
good for you.
And I'll just say what the truth. Anyway, what I see with the court system is I see, a continuous dealing going on. Hey, we know he deserves 5 years, but we want to get it off our table. Let's give him 6 months or 30 days or whatever the case may be. The burden of proof is almost impossible to meet. I mean, officers now don't make arrests that they should because they know the case isn't going to be filed.
Yep.
And even when we do arrest somebody, you know, you're talking about maybe 60% of the cases will actually get filed. And so that means those other people get set free. And even when the case is filed, unless it's a significant felony, you're looking at, you know, probation. We have a thing called Prop 36 out here, and it used to be we could arrest the drug offenders and put them in prison for several years, and we know that most drug offenders are committing many other crimes we just haven't caught them for. Well, now what happened is Proposition 36 was passed by the California voters, and every drug offense is offered a diversionary rehabilitation program, which doesn't work. The people that are in the actual education program will tell you it doesn't work. They're just playing the game so they can check the box and get it off their record and go back to committing their crimes and using their drugs. It's a flawed system. It's an overburdened system. There's no consequences to anybody's actions anymore. There's no personal responsibility. We're in a demise. We're in a spiral, and I don't see it ending. I blame a lot of the problems in our country on attorneys.
Yep.
They have the opportunity. They own the system. Attorneys are judges. Judges are, you know, politicians.
Yep.
Most of our presidents are attorneys. Most of our city council and elected state officials are attorneys. They run the country, and they do nothing about it.
Amen. Boy, you said that well. Let's talk about your book a little bit. We just have a few minutes left here.
Great.
How to Get Hired by Police and Fire. It's an admirable profession. You and I got into it for, well, my family. I come from a military and law enforcement background. The young boy that always wants to be the policeman or the fireman, you look at some of the old TV shows with Jack Webb, and it kind of got you interested in
right.
What... But that glamour era of being in police and fire has changed somewhat now, because when we talked about it earlier, you get put on that... You're put on trial immediately when you become a police officer, and you have to live under so many rules and regulations that it's not the perp that goes on trial, it's whether or not the officer dotted all his I's and crossed all his T's. Plus the pay seems to have gotten worse and worse and worse. I've done several shows, Pete, on the Border Patrol agents that are currently serving time for shooting the drug dealer. Yeah, drug dealer in the rear end, and you look at the kind of money that they would make. What entices people to get into police and fire today? Are they enticed? And let's talk about what your book talks about.
You know, like we talked about earlier, I think you don't have a choice when you get into police or fire. I think it's just intrinsic. It's just something you have to do. And you're right, the pay, it's okay out here, but it doesn't compensate you for the amount of knowledge that you have to have. We pretty much become experts on almost everything.
Yeah.
From all the calls you go on, and just a lot of general knowledge that the regular person doesn't have. Plus, you almost become a psychologist without a degree. It's kind of incredible. And the thinking under pressure is what separates us, I think, from rest of society. We're able to think very rapidly in evolving. Major. Intensely evolving situations. So what my book does is it talks about all these situations, and it kind of encourages you to look at yourself and say, is this really what you're supposed to be doing? Because I always say, if the book encourages you or discourages you to go into law enforcement or firefighting, either way it's the right decision. And I get into all the issues and all the problems that you'll have. You know, almost every officer out here I know has high blood pressure, and it's just part of what you can expect. The media, I'll tell you, a couple days ago I was doing a use of force investigation on three of my guys. This parolee that didn't want to go to jail ended up in this huge fight. He's trying to take the officer's guns, and they're tasing him. They tased him five times with no effect. They're hitting him. He's hitting them. He's got an open handcuff swinging around. They're worried about it's, you know, cutting their face. This was a major fight, you know, something that you only get in a few times in your career. And a 20-year veteran disclosed to me that when he was kneeing this guy in the chest during the fight, he started thinking about who was watching.
Exactly.
And I go, you know, and he knows he was wrong to do that, but he's a 20-year veteran, and he's thinking like this. What must we be doing to our rookies and our younger officers? And they're going to get hurt. It's just like 2 weeks ago, two officers in North Carolina were killed with their own gun in a fight. And, you know, without second-guessing them because we weren't there, and, you know, God bless them, and I my heart breaks as yours does. But, you know, maybe if they used more violent force at the beginning, that wouldn't have happened. So you need to be prepared to use violent force, and then also be prepared to answer the second guessers and the media that may have a video of you. Well, why did you do this?
Yeah.
And why did you do that? They won't understand, but you need to be prepared for that, because it will happen.
Well, like the old song goes, Pete, they should walk a mile in our shoes. The website is www.hiredbypolice.com. Pete Bollinger, thank you for dropping by. I'd love to have you on again sometime.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate it. God bless.
Take care. We'll be right back. All right, that's the police perspective. Now, I want the media perspective in the high-profile case like the Virginia Tech massacre. Eric Spinato is a senior cable news producer who has worked on many stories like this, Columbine included. He and I sat down to talk about this type of story and the media. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Eric Sonato is a former MSNBC producer that was instrumental in the high-profile case story about Diane Zamora. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. The Texas cadet murder. NBC's Stone Phillips did a story on that case. And I've got him on the air here with me right now to talk a little bit about that case. And with the Virginia Tech massacre going on, or that has gone on right now, and all the news coverage that we're seeing, I want to get someone who has a perspective as far as the media goes on how the reporting has been going on. We've seen nonstop coverage on this, and I think it's important for everyone to hear about the case. But how is the media doing as far as their reporting goes? Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dana, for having me.
No, you're no stranger to high-profile cases and producing stories. The Texas cadet murder is one of them. Tell us a little bit about that story, and then we'll get into Virginia Tech.
Well, the Texas cadet story was a story that happened about 11 to 12 years ago. At that time, a 17-year-old woman named Diane Zamora, who was a cadet along with her boyfriend at that time, David Graham, was basically two people who are deeply in love with one another, but also push each other's buttons during their relationship. And at one point, David told Diane that he had an affair and slept with a woman named Adrienne Jones, someone that Diane knew of only, but not close friends with. And apparently, Diane told David, this is according to court records, Diane, of course, disagrees with this, but David was told by Diane, well, now you have to kill her. And then, therefore, a plan was devised, and I believe in 94, 95 of December, where they Diane was hiding in the back of a truck, or car, excuse me, of David, would pick up Adrienne, and there's Diane back of, you know, sitting in the back of the car, hiding. And then eventually was brought to some deserted area in a dirt road, and that's where Diane came out in front and confronted Adrienne, saying, "Well, you know, how was it like sleeping with my boyfriend?"
Right.
And of course, Adrienne said it did not happen. What happened, Dana, was David just said this. David just said this. This is the kind of relationship they had. I guess he was mad at Diane and told her that he slept with her. Of course, Diane and David, that was both of them were true first-time love, and apparently it was not true. And David, some struggle happened. What happened was they were confronting Adrienne, and a struggle occurred. And apparently Diane allegedly hit her in the head with a dumbbell that was in the car. Well, Adrienne was not knocked out unconscious. She was able somehow, believe it or not, to struggle outside of the passenger side window.
Mm-hmm.
And as she was running away,
David followed her and eventually shot her a couple times. Now, what's amazing is a crime happened, and Diane was, I think, again, there's two sides to the story, but the story in a court of law was that she was convicted of telling, knowing a crime was going to happen, telling David to kill Adrian, and both of them were sentenced to 40 years in life. What's ironic is, till this day, Diane's story really hasn't changed that much because she says she never told David to murder Adrian Jones. What she is guilty of is, you know, covering up a crime of a scene, of course, knowing a murder happened, not going to authorities when she should have, and of course, she got rid of some bloody clothes. The other thing that really did them in, Dana, was both of them gave a written confession. It was almost identical, verbatim, of exactly what happened. And ultimately, that confession definitely put the nail in the coffin, I believe, for her.
Yeah, researched or rehearsed confessions between two is sometimes the nail in the coffin, like you say. And the conspiracy aspect of the story is what makes it so interesting. But I want to ask you, Eric, while I've got you here, the public's fascination with these types of high-profile cases. Media has turned quite a bit here in the last few years to these types of stories with the Dateline shows and the 48 Hours and the cable news shows, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, I do it here on my program too. Why are the public, or why is the public so fascinated with these high-profile cases? It seems like it's a never-ending story of content after content. We'll never run out of stories because, sadly, that's the way things go in society.
Listen, any crime's horrific. But you know what? Even though I'm a journalist, I think what I'm fascinated by, and I think the average person is a couple of things. You can't fathom someone doing this. You want to know what went through that person's mind.
Right.
Move forward and to do it. And sometimes these stories are really, you know, a whodunit or he said, she said.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's unbelievable, you know, police work done every day. I mean, they want to solve every single crime. Unfortunately, you can't, but they do a great job. I made a lot of friends over the years with a lot of great detectives. At the same time, you know, there is a percentage of someone incarcerated wrongly behind jail. And as a journalist, you always want to give the benefit of the doubt. And I mean, if someone says they're innocent, I mean, it depends on, you know, case by case. I've interviewed a couple of death row people and serial killers, Danny Rawlings. I was the last journalist to do an interview with him in Gainesville, Florida. And, you know, that guy admitted his crime. But that guy was crazy. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, heard voices, you know, a devil named Jeremiah was telling him what to do. But Diane, here you are, a very, very smart woman, and David Graham. They both went to two prominent cadets. She went to Annapolis in Maryland. Honor student, very smart, clean record, but look what happened. Ruined her life because they were both too deeply in love, and there are so many stories I have read and covered in my career where we all sometimes can relate, where you're in a relationship and sometimes you snap. But in this case, you know, murdering is something I just can't fathom. How someone can actually do it is one thing to say it, but to go through with it is mind-boggling to me. But at the same time, if there is something in this person's story that can educate people from young to old, of course it depends on the story, I think that's my job as a journalist to try to provide that and understand it and explain it maybe to those that are just curious. And that's why I think criminal stories are just fascinating, because it's, you know, goes back to the Sherlock Holmes days, you know, just who done it and who's really responsible. And that's the, you know, the great job that police officers do every day, and detectives.
And the media has been doing a great job with it also, because they are investigating sometimes better than the law enforcement side can, because of say manpower issues, money issues, or whatever, and the public has that great fascination. The good journalist that you are, you've segued right into my next question here. We have the Virginia Tech massacre situation now. It's tragic. The media is covering it, I think, in a very good way. Media, like law enforcement, are damned if they do and damned if they don't. So they have to go out and do the best job that they can. Your thoughts on the tragedy and how the media has been handling it?
Well, let me first by saying that my thoughts are with all of those family members.
Yes.
Because it's like almost reliving it for me, because I covered Columbine when it happened. I was working at a network, and I had to go out to Columbine and cover it. So, you know, there's one thing to watch it, Dana, on TV unfold, and it's another thing as a journalist to actually be at the scene. It takes an emotional toll on you as a journalist, because you're seeing people's hearts literally torn apart. I mean, their son, their daughter, whatever the relationship is, just gone forever for a senseless crime that this guy did. Now, yes, he put some signs out there, and that's, I think, very, very important to scrutinize. But right now, I think it's to remember these students and professors, and then go move forward and say, okay, what could we have done better for the next possible child that needs counseling? You know, how we can better, you know, do it. Because, like, as you know, as a former police officer, you know, just, you know, there's so many people every day that have a problem. The question is, who's that one person that's going to cross that line and do something that, like I said, I couldn't fathom that this guy did. So as far as the media, it's a big story. There's a lot of lives covered. You want to cover accurate, and you want to be fair and balanced. And I just think it's important that, you know, don't rush the judgment. I mean, let the law, you know, as the police officers release the information, that's what journalists really should go by. And if they know something that might cause, you know, a problem with family members, I think, you know, like, you know, the video, it's something that's so sensitive. You damn if you do and damn if you don't. And, you know, I think every journalist, if they were able to get their hands on any evidence like a network did, like NBC, I mean, It's a tough call, because I think everyone wants to see who's this person that did something so senseless. So the question is, if it's a video form or a still photo, it takes a real editorial judgment to, you know, because you have to be sensitive again to the family members, what you want to release. And of course, the authorities, if I'm correct, the authorities knew about it beforehand, and they applauded, you know, NBC on how they handle it. So I don't know how much more you can do from that.
Well, there's a big aspect of this, like you said earlier, is education. And we have to educate the public however we do it, whether you're in law enforcement or you are in journalism or broadcasting, as far as the facts of the case and what we can do to try and prevent another case from happening, whether it's the safety aspect. There's a whole bunch of different side stories to this, everything from gun control to mental health issues. This is just a generic question, somewhat of a hypothetical. Sadly, there will probably be another situation like this sometime, somewhere. What can we in the media do better to prepare the folks for something like this?
I think, you know, believe it or not, every local news market is the best place, in my opinion, because, you know, a network can't concentrate on every single school. You know what I mean? Like, you could do a segment, say, okay, how do we educate everyone better? But I'll tell you, here on Long Island, there was a local newspaper that just came, actually, I just read it, it was very interesting. They interviewed various presidents of colleges to see what they have in place already, you know, post-Columbine, and, of course, the Virginia Tech shooting. And it's very interesting on just, you know, at least half a dozen are ill-prepared or, you know, have some type of plan. So, I mean, I think it comes down to really the local journalist, you know, local news outlets to focus on that. And I think based on, you know, as things are printed or reported, you kind of get a bigger scope of what needs to be done. And it always comes down to money for security.
Yeah.
But I think look at guidance counselors. I mean, look at Professor. Professor saw something, and she came forward. But I think it's going to get to a point where when you have more than several warnings of someone, just something is emotionally wrong with that child or an adult, you really have to pay attention. It's got to get to a point where you really got to pay attention.
Yeah,
otherwise, like you said, you know, it's like, you know, how many flights there are a day? You don't want to see a plane crash.
Yep.
But, you know, they do a great job making sure those planes go up where there's not going to be a problem. But it's like when something this magnitude happens, again, it just puts in the forefront to say, you know, it can happen in your backyard, no matter where you live in the United States. It's just a question of educating people, the warning signs, and, of course, you know, it's also reverse. It's like now the people in Columbine have toured, you know, after that incident, and they were able to help other schools, and the students were able to help other students understand, you know, how their life has changed. And you'll see that from Virginia Tech also.
Absolutely. And I want to, just before I let you go, Eric, the aspect of we hear about the victims, we hear about the psychopathic shooter, we hear all the stories of courage and heroism. We don't hear a lot about the police officers that attend the scene. Again, they seem to be criticized initially, but we don't hear about the human aspect of it. I want you to talk a little bit about the human aspect of the reporter. Like you say, watching it on television is one thing. Being at the scene is another thing. And I tell you, there are a lot of professional reporters, producers, journalists that are out there that handle it. But it's got to be difficult from the human aspect, too, to keep that TV face all the time and not show the emotions that are natural.
Yeah. I mean, it's every, you know, story that I cover, and I'm speaking to someone who's has lost a loved one or who's been involved in a criminal act, maybe assault, rape. It's, yeah, you know, you have to have a straight, you know, you have to focus on that person, listen to them. It's important to listen to these people and care. And then hopefully you can turn that story into a, you know, some information like, you know, here's what we, what you can do. Here's maybe what we all can do better. But, yeah, it definitely takes a toll because, you know, it's one thing seeing it unfold on TV. It can affect you. But when you're actually at the location, it's different. It's just different. You know, 9/11, I had to work, you know, from the office. And I always wanted to go down there, but part of me is actually glad I didn't go down there because, you know, again, seeing it on TV and honestly hearing it from people saying, oh, my God, it is different than seeing something on TV. It's huge. It's bigger. It's, you know, it's not, you know, a 32-inch TV you're looking at. I mean, you're looking at the actual whole perspective of the crime scene.
Yep.
And as far as with these people, you know, it can happen to me. And as a journalist, again, you want to cope them, you want to make them understand that life will move forward, and hopefully we can do the best thing to remember their loved one in our reporting, and again, just inform people. I mean, that's the whole point of journalists, is also not just to report, but to educate and inform, and that, I think that's something I enjoy at many times when I'm able to cover a story.
Eric Sonato, thanks for dropping by and sharing with us the perspective of the media and reporting cases like this. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dennis.
Take care. Bye-bye. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. And we are here on Scared Monkeys Radio, and I want to thank Eric Spinato for coming on to talk about the media perspective of this case, Virginia Tech, and other high-profile cases. I'm going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with tonight's final segment here on the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio.
The girl that wears the tight blue jeans, she's the chick who knows everything. She's the girl that can shake that thing. She ain't got no time on me. Be-bop-a-loo-la, she's my baby. Be-bop-a-loo-la, I don't need baby. Be-bop-a-loo-la.
shakes that thing. She's the girlie that knows everything. She's a chick that I love so.
And when they start to kiss and wear me,
sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away. Nothing else could come between. But now you've left me to love another. You have shattered all of my dreams. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away.
I always hated that third verse.
It was a nice short version.
Do you want to pick it up?
No, it's all right.
Is it good?
We got a short version.
Might have that better verse on that better tape.
What do you want to do? Let's, well, if I feel like my song is sung, it don't care. I don't care if it's short.
There you have it.
And I feel like my song is sung. It was 2 minutes. I've recorded songs 2 minutes.
I got a special story for you now. I'm trying to actually get my next guest on the phone, but we're having some cell phone difficulty. But regardless, I can still tell you about the story. Cheyenne Jackson contacted me the other day. Now, she's been on this program before talking about her missing brother, Cole Jackson. If you go to the Texas EquiSearch webpage, you'll find more information about Cole Jackson. Or go to myspace.com/ColeJackson. That's myspace.com/ColeJackson. Cole is C-O-L-E, Jackson, common spelling, 33. So myspace.com/ColeJackson33, and you'll learn more about Cole. Anyway, Cheyenne called me the other day, or emailed me the other day, I should say, and asked about a young fella that, or asked me to talk about a young fella, a young boy with cancer up here in Canada, Shane Benir, I think is how you say this. I hope I'm pronouncing his name properly. He's a young guy that is wanting to have his wish that he receive as many birthday cards as he can to meet the Guinness World Book of Records record, okay? And I ask you to go to his webpage at Shane, S-H-A-N-E, Bernier, B-E-R-N-I-E-R, .ca, ShaneBernier.ca. 7-year-old Shane is a brave cancer patient at CHAO, and he's asking people to send him a card for his birthday on May 30th. Shane wants to set a world record for the most number of cards received. You don't have to wait for his birthday to send your cards. Start by sending them today. Now just go to that webpage again, shanebernier.com, or .ca, I'm sorry. It's shanebernier.ca. You'll see this young boy, very brave young boy, and send him a birthday card. There's a couple of examples here to Shane Bernier, B-E-R-N-I-E-R, Box 484, Lancaster, Ontario, Canada, KOC1NO. That's Shane Bernier, Box 484, Lancaster, Ontario, Canada, KOC1NO. And there you can send your birthday card, and there's a couple of examples on the webpage at shanebernier.ca. Shane Bernier, S-H-A-N-B-E-R-N-I-E-R.ca. Let's see what we can do to help this young boy. It won't cost you much to send him a birthday card. He's wanting to get into the Guinness World Book of Records. He's a cancer patient, and if we can't help him, I don't know who we can help. And I was hoping Cheyenne Jackson would have been able to stop on the show tonight to talk about this, but I'm having some problems getting her on the phone. I'm going to take one more break and see if I can get her, and we'll return in a minute here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Our webpage is www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio.
First mom and papa called him little boy Ned, raised him on the banks of a riverbed.
The Dana Pretzer Show for April 20th, 2007. I remind you, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. There you can listen to the show live, download podcasts of past shows, listen to my daily commentary, leave comments, whatever. I do appreciate your listenership, And we'll see you again real soon. And I thank all my guests for joining me this evening. Remember, the creme de la creme of blogs is scaredmonkeys.com, and it's my honor to be part of their organization with these programs. We'll be back real soon with another live show. Again, scaredmonkeys.com/radio. Good night, everybody.
All right, let him have it.
How lucky can one guy be? I kissed her and she kissed me. Like the fella once said, ain't that a kick in the head? The room was completely black. I hugged her and she hugged back. Like the sailor said, quote, ain't that a hole in a boat?